The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, I'm Kyle Smith. I'm curator of the Fleischer Collection of Orchestral Music here at the Free Library of Philadelphia, and it seems... Oh, thank you so much. I believe that I've come to Alex Ross's love of the whole world of music, that is pop and classical, from the opposite direction that he took. He knew only classical music up until his college years. He writes in his new book, Listen to This, that most of you have, when he discovered pop music of various sorts. For me, other than the hymns and liturgy of my church, middle-brow choir literature in school, and the occasional hallelujah chorus, my upbringing was basically an immersion in the commercial top 40 of the 1960s and early 70s. Now, Alex Ross wanted to become a composer, and then he discovered the writing of words. I wanted to be Harold Hill in The Music Man, or maybe a backup singer for the Delphonics. And then I discovered Brahms. Well, Ross is writing now, and I'm composing, and he probably wouldn't be tempted by my music to try his hand at composition as Brahms pulled me in, but do I love how Alex Ross puts words on the page. For instance, is there a better short overview of the entire life and works of Mozart than what we find in Listen to This? It includes this luscious description that will not leave my mind. Quote, counterpoint and dissonance are the cables on which Mozart's bridges to paradise hang. Or is there a better history of the entirety of Western music than what Ross illuminates using the lament motif as his searchlight? I believe you'll hear more about that tonight. By the way, cell phones, right? Okay. Do that while I'm talking. Thank you. There's a moment when he describes what is most precious in the music of Björk that, for me, sums up the entire book, and that tension between classical and pop that I still feel. This is what he writes. Music is restored to its original bliss, free both of the fear of pretension that limits popular music and of the fear of vulgarity that limits classical music. Now, it's what I've always thought, but I wish I'd thought of that clearly. For Alex Ross's writing is not the kind of writing that pummels you with erudition. And don't get me wrong, he is that smart. But he doesn't make you feel like you are that dumb. And it's not the kind of writing that calls attention to itself either. This is what he says about Frank Sinatra. Listen to this. The voice was veering in the opposite direction from the legend. Sinatra was a lean young man who grew wealthy and stout, but it's his younger voice that sounds plump, and it's his older voice that sounds thin and hungry. That's an amazing sentence. Now, there's a lot going on with that, and it's made all the more remarkable because there are no remarkable words in it. Oh, stout and plump are paralleled, and maybe they're a bit out of the way, but if I had a year to think up of one word that describes Sinatra's young voice, I'd never come up with plump. But it's so right. This kind of writing comes from a steady focus on the subject, but even so, there's something else going on here. This kind of writing comes from reaching deep into one's own self to find that nugget of truth, no matter how difficult it is to find, that revealing is obvious to all. This is magnificent writing. Listen to this. Ladies and gentlemen, Alex Ross.
Thank you so much, Kyle, for that incredibly kind introduction. I'm very deeply flattered and very happy to be back here at the Free Library. I was last here in the company of John Adams, the composer, and now I'm flying solo, so I'll do my best. But I'm very happy that all of you came out tonight. The title of this talk is going to be Ciccone, Lamento, Walking Blues, Bass Lines of Music History. And this is the title of the second chapter of my new book, Listen to This, which I wrote fresh for the volume. Most everything else comes from pieces that appeared in The New Yorker, or in one case, the New Republic, although I did do quite a bit of rewriting and added considerable portions along the way. But this piece has never appeared anywhere else, so hopefully you get a little more bang for your buck that way. And it really encapsulates the theme of the book and perhaps all the writing that I've done over the years in The New Yorker and elsewhere, which is to write not just about the music itself, but its place in the wider culture, and to look for continuities and hidden links among various genres of music and across a span of time, sort of searching for, in this case, common strands, almost like strands of musical DNA that might tie all of the diverse languages and cultures of music together. And it's somewhat speculative because we can't pin music down in this way, but this is my attempt. And as Kyle noted, it is also an attempt at a whirlwind history, almost of all of music, or as much of it as I could encompass, in about 10,000 words told through these recurring motifs. There's a lot of ground I want to cover, so I'll jump right in with the dance known as the Ciccone. One evening in the month of roses, a dancing party was held. It gave a thousand pleasures, its fame went far and wide. To life, to the good life, la vida buona, let's all go to Ciccone. This is Un Sarau de la Ciccone, a song published in 1624 by the Spanish musician Juan Arañez. It tells of various scandalous shenanigans at the wedding of a man named Almadan. A blind man pokes girls with a stick. An African heathen sings with a gypsy. A doctor wears pans around his neck for some reason. Drunks, thieves, cuckolds, brawlers, and men and women of ill repute complete the scene. The Ciccone became very popular at the beginning of the 17th century, too popular for the Spanish King's Council, which banned it from public theaters. Its lyrics tended to be bawdy, sexually suggestive, with a hint of subversion in its picture of topsy-turvy goings-on. One question I want to ask tonight is, how do you get from that to this? This is also called Ciccone, as many of you know, Bach's Ciccone in D minor from the second partita for solo violin. The two pieces seem to have nothing in common beyond the fact that they are both in triple meter with an emphasis on the second beat. It's a case of total musical transformation across a relatively short span of time, less than a century. Like a cityscape, music is always furiously changing, often beyond recognition. Yet you can also find features of the landscape that have changed surprisingly little. In the following two excerpts, we'll make a jump of more than 300 years, yet the bass remains the same. Monteverdi's Lamento della Ninfa, Lament of the Nymph, followed, of course, by Ray Charles. These four notes, have been sounding through music for hundreds of years. They can mean many different things, but they often seem associated with feelings of sorrow, especially when they move slowly in even values. I want to begin this with this little signal of lament. It seems to take off from a physical fact. A crying, sobbing, or sighing person emits sounds that slide gradually downward in pitch, then return to a higher pitch to begin the slide again. The same contour can be found in laments around the world. It seems to evoke not only the sounds that we make when in distress, but also the inward state of our minds and bodies. The depressed person feels literally pulled downward. The face, shoulders, and arms droop in sympathy. It also metaphorically suggests a descent to the grave or the netherworld. But there's also something cathartic about letting out these sounds, releasing them into the world. We always feel better after we cry. It's a very basic, primitive, mammalian thing to do. Animals make very similar sounds. That was Malina. Listening to folk music recordings, especially from Eastern Europe, you hear that four-note falling pattern, often in songs of sorrow. Here is a Romanian bocet, or lament. Draga! In a Hungarian village, a woman uses a similar figure to sing, "Oh, woe is me, what have I done against the great Lord that he has taken my beloved spouse away?" Now listen to the Sigiriya form of flamenco. "I always find you weeping in the corners," the flamenco master Manuel Torres recorded in 1922. From the fact that many funeral songs go downward in pitch, it does not follow that every descending melody has lamentation on its mind. You can find plentiful counterexamples, and I list some in my book. I'm not sure that any figures in music carry an intrinsic meaning. But this motif does seem to have acquired definite recurring associations in multiple traditions. It has a tendency toward lament, and I'll leave it at that. Now let's turn to notated music from the Renaissance period. Around 1460, the Franco-Flemish composer Johannes Ockeghem, who created polyphonic works of dazzling and dizzying complexity, wrote a chanson entitled Four Seulement. The cheery text begins with the lines, "Save only for the expectation of death, no hope dwells in my weary heart." The opening notes, setting the words Four Seulement, trace out what I'm going to call the classic form of lament, that four-note folkish motif. By the middle of the 16th century, scholars were beginning to evolve a rough musical vocabulary of lament. In 1558, Josefo Zarlino instructed composers to use cheerful harmonies and fast rhythms for cheerful subjects, and sad harmonies and grave rhythms for sad subjects. That much seems obvious. When a composer wishes to express effects of grief and sorrow, he should, observing the rules given, use movements which proceed through the semitone, a reference to the chromatic scale. This, for those who don't know, is the scale that moves up or down by half steps. It's very simple. Just think of consecutive notes on the piano keyboard, black and white. I'll be referring to this many times as we go forward. It seems like an intensification of this musical gesture of lament. With the smaller subdivisions, we're getting closer to the primal sliding sound of the cry or the sob. A grieving stepwise descent became commonplace in Italian madrigals of the later 16th century, including some famously intricate examples by Carlo Gesualdo, the homicidal prince of Venosa. It's also a feature of music of the Elizabethan period in England, where there was a great deal of flamboyant brooding in the Hamlet style. The supreme melancholic among English composers was the brilliant songwriter and lutenist John Doland, who, for better or worse, has experienced a resurgence in recent years thanks to the efforts of Sting. In a solo lute piece entitled Forlorn Hope Fancy, Doland made obsessive use of a descending chromatic gesture. Yet Doland also had a flair for hummable melody. Another lute piece entitled Lacrimae, Tears, became immensely popular across Europe in the last years of the 16th century. When Doland published his second book of songs in 1600, he included a vocal version of this Lacrimae air with words that Hamlet might comfortably have spoken. Flow my tears, fall from your springs, exiled forever let me mourn. Where night's black bird her sad infamy sings, there let me live forlorn. Fans of the novelist Philip K. Dick know that he borrowed this title for one of his most famous books, Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said.
Thank you.
And there again, at the beginning of the melody, you hear those four falling notes of lament. Just at the time when Dolan was most active as a composer, the cicona came into view. It was first cited by name in 1598 in Peru, actually, although it may well have been much older. By 1606, the cicona was appearing in manuals for amateur guitarists. The written versions are essentially formulaic chord progressions over which the player is encouraged to improvise variations. The first composer to begin to do something with this form was Girolamo Frescobaldi, whose Partite sopra cicona, or Variations on the cicona, appeared in 1627. Frescobaldi also wrote variations on a related Spanish dance form, the Pasacalia. Frescobaldi's Partite are sophisticated, fantastically inventive, almost avant-garde, subjecting the formulas to constant elaboration. You hear these odd little harmonic twinges, these momentary darkenings of mood. This merry dance is beginning to be infected by traces of lament. Monteverdi, the leading Italian composer of the day, also joined in the cicona fad. In 1632, he published the duet Zeffiro Torna with a buoyant, fast-moving bass line expressing a merry springtime mood. No lament here, but a few years later, Monteverdi wrote Lamento della Ninfa, which we heard earlier next to Ray Charles, and now the hypnotically repeating bass line, which was such a feature of these dances, acquires tragic import. The disconsolate nymph is singing, "Let my lover become again what he once was, or else kill me so that I torment myself no more." The vocal line moves laboriously upward step by step. The bass moves steadily down in the now familiar four-note pattern. It's Bernarda Fink singing. The repetition of the dance has been fused with the lament figure, creating this sensuous, mesmerizing melancholy, pain and pleasure mixed. The music mimics beautifully the obsessive habits of the lovelorn mind. The musical term for such unvarying repetition is ostinato, from the Italian word for obstinate. That lamenting, repeating bass line was taken up by Monteverdi's younger colleague, Francesco Cavalli, whose name is now known mostly to enthusiasts of Baroque opera, but who was among the most successful and widely performed composers of his time. He came up with an important innovation. He added two notes to the repeating pattern so that it became chromatic. And here again, you'll hear my marvelous piano playing. Sort of at the limits there of my technical capability. This transformation of the bass line happens in Cavalli's opera La Didone. It tells of Dido, queen of Carthage, who falls in love with the Trojan Aeneas and then kills herself when the gods summon Aeneas away to found Rome. But the first act is set in Troy, and we hear, among others, Hecuba, widow of King Priam, lamenting the death and destruction all around her. Opera was relatively new at this time, less than 50 years old. Cavalli helped establish many of its characteristics. Above all, he was known for these moments in which characters step forward and unleash a storm of emotion. We're seeing the emergence of the aria, the great diva or divo display. The ostinato proved to be a crucial device in his armory. The emotion keeps getting heightened in the voice as the steady repetition continues. Let's listen to a later part of Hecuba's lament in which she takes on a prophetic, apocalyptic tone, as if not only remembering the fall of Troy, but foreseeing the demise of regimes to come. Porticos, temples are shaking and trembling, burning and tumbling. Purple and empire turn into dust, make clothes of ashes. And the chromatic pattern is in the bass. It's Marie-Claire Lemieux singing. Oops, sorry. Operatic prophecies of doom were not so common in later 17th century France, where Louis XIV appropriated opera as an image of his worldly power. Jean-Baptiste Lully, the Florence-born musician who went on to become the supreme musical figure at the court of Louis XIV, very often installed grand chaconnes at the ends of his operas and ballets, using them to show the reconciliation of warring forces and the restoration of happiness. Yet the chaconne had not altogether lost its original exotic association. It was defined in 1690 as a dance which came from the Moors. As scholars have observed, Lully connected his chaconnes to the representation of Italian, Spanish, North African, even Chinese characters and locales. The Ballet d'Alcidiane et Polyxandre from 1658 contains a chaconne des Moors, chaconne of the Moors, accompanying the entry of Moorish slaves playing the guitar. Thank you. Amazingly enough, when this was first staged, Louis XIV himself appeared as one of the dancing Moors wearing a black mask. English composers of the later 1600s remained entranced by the lamenting properties of the descending chromatic line, which Doland had helped to introduce some decades before. Mr. Henry Purcell often reached for the downward trudging figure to convey the blacker end of the emotional spectrum, as in Plunged in the Confines of Despair. Or, "Oh, I'm sick of life." Sometimes you just wake up feeling that way. But Purcell's greatest lament was given to the long-suffering Dido. He took up the Venetian opera device of the chromatic ground bass, which Cavalli had introduced in his Dido opera, and used it to even more heart-stopping effect. He took care first to introduce the bass line on its own, so there can be no mistaking its operation in the music to follow. It's like a grand, chilly staircase appearing before one's feet. Over it, Dido sings her valediction, "When I am laid in earth, may my wrongs create no trouble in thy breast. Remember me, but ah, forget my fate." Here is the great Lorraine Hunt Lieberson singing with the Philharmonia Baroque. I'll return to this music at the very end. By the early 18th century, the old cicconna was more than a century old, and it was fading from view in many European countries. It persisted, though, in instrumental music, especially in Germany, where it took on an increasingly somber character. Johann Pachelbel is famous or infamous for his soothing canon in D, which actually has a certain chaconne-like swing to it. But the finale of his prelude, fugue, and chaconne for organ is actually somewhat frightening. Good choice for your Halloween party, maybe. We are very close now to the world of Bach. His chaconne for solo violin is so aggressively devoid of La Vida Buona that the title seems almost perverse. The two main forms of musical lament, that four-note descent and the chromatic version, are heard throughout, woven into the texture in various ways. The chromatic kind stabs at the ear in Variation 5. The chaconne contains an extended major key episode that functions as a kind of respite from the reigning darkness of the piece. But when we hear a descending chromatic line high in the treble, we may sense that these happy days are numbered. Shortly after, D minor returns over a classic four-note lamento. This is Gidon Kremer playing from his ECM recording of the complete sonatas and partitas. It's interesting how different and yet how natural the chaconne sounds when it is played on a guitar, here in the hands of Andres Segovia. Perhaps we have not come as far from the original chaconne as we may think. We are certainly not too far from flamenco in its most tragic mode. At the end of his life, Bach assembled his Mass in B minor, rearranging extant works from his catalog and writing some new music to complete the towering conception of the piece. In the Crucifixus, representing the death of Jesus Christ on the cross, Bach turned, inevitably perhaps, to the crawling lamento bass. For our sake, he was crucified, suffered under Pontius Pilate, and was buried. We feel again the individual straining against the ostinato of fate. The bass line is repeated 13 times. The voices push against its implacable descent, moving in various directions. There are slowly pulsing chords of strings on the first and third beats, flutes on the second and third. They suggest something dripping. Perhaps blood from Christ's wounds or tears from the eyes of his followers. In the 13th iteration, the bass singers give up their contrary motion and join the downward march of the continuo section. The sopranos, too, take a chromatic path. The upper instruments drop out, a dramatic effect suggesting that the dripping has stopped and that life is spent. The victory of the bass line seems complete. But suddenly it reverses direction, and there is a momentous last-minute swerve from E minor into the key of G major. On the next page, the resurrection begins. Here, without commercial interruption, is the Crucifixus from the Mass in B minor, performed by the Collegium Vocal Ghent under Philippe Herrevega. In the later 18th century, forms based on strict repetition, such as the chaconne, the passacaglia, and the lamento aria, became scarce. Music was becoming more linear, more narrative. From Haydn and Mozart onward, composers prized constant development. Restless changes of key made it unlikely that a given piece or movement would be tied together with a fixed, recurring pattern. The lamento became a somewhat antique device, even a cliché. Already in Mozart, it seems to have an archaic air. He was familiar with the descending chromatic figure from an early age, and I do mean early, the age of 9. The figure shows up in many of the sacred works that Mozart was required to churn out during his youth in Salzburg. Later, it seems to serve as a signifier of ancient, solemn, uncanny forces. At the beginning of Don Giovanni in the overture, a forbidding chromatic descent anticipates the entrance of the stone statue of the Commendatore. Beethoven, at the end of his tragic-minded first movement of his Ninth Symphony, employs a chromatic ostinato to create a kind of official funerary atmosphere, and we know from his letters that the bass line of Bach's Crucifixus interested him. Tchaikovsky's Pathetique Symphony is unambiguously a symphony of fate and death. In the finale, a movement marked Adagio Lamentoso, we should not be surprised to find lamento lines everywhere. The classic four saumon form. Is combined with the chromatic lamento. At the end of the 19th century, a growing interest in the pre-Romantic past, and this was the time when everyone was trying to overcome the influence of Wagner, led to a revival of Renaissance and Baroque forms and techniques. Johannes Brahms, the reigning classicist in German music, capped his final symphony, the Fourth, with an archaic-sounding, though immensely forceful finale that seems to draw on dark old chaconnes by Buxtehude, Pachelbel, and Bach. In the 20th century, the chaconne and the passacaglia, its sibling form, unexpectedly returned to fashion as composers looked to the distant past for clues to the chaotic present. Alban Berg inserted a passacaglia in his opera Wozzeck, a tale of the endless madness of military life. Both Benjamin Britten and Dmitri Shostakovich used the recurring bass lines of the passacaglia to suggest the inescapable tensions of modern existence. In the late 20th century, the great Hungarian composer György Ligeti showed a particular fascination with this material. In 1993, I heard Ligeti give a talk at the New England Conservatory in which he gave a whirlwind history of chaconne, passacaglia, and lament. That lecture, to a great extent, inspired this one and the corresponding essay in my book. But I'd like to move on and talk, finally, about the blues. Coincidentally or not, you find a falling chromatic figure, not quite the same as the ones we've been hearing, but similar in profile, all over the blues and so much of the popular music that followed. It's particularly pronounced in the blues of the Mississippi Delta, where you keep finding this emphatically repeating line plucked out on the guitar, as in Willie Brown's Future Blues. Or Skip James, Devil Got My Woman. or Robert Johnson, Walkin' Blues.
I woke up this morning, getting around for my shoes. Her bag got this, walking blues. Woke up this morning.
Of course, this music has, or seems to have, very different roots. But you still feel the age-old downward pull of that series of notes. Of course, this being the blues, it won't do to describe the song simply as laments. There is sensualism here and toughness, a sense of resistance and resilience, so that that tinge of sadness seems to reverse itself and in some way create its opposite. As Wynton Marsalis says, blues are an inoculation. You give yourself a little to keep the real blues away. Traces of lament also appear in Tin Pan Alley music back in the period of the 20s, 30s, and 40s. George Gershwin loved to introduce slinky chromatic patterns in the inner voices of songs like Someone to Watch Over Me. Richard Rodgers sneaks a hint of lamento into My Funny Valentine. Frank Sinatra, who sang this repertory so magnificently, was, I think, especially drawn to songs that contained that melancholy stepwise figure. Here's the end of Angel Eyes.
Pardon me, but I gotta run. The facts uncommonly clear. I gotta find who's now the number one, and why my angel eyes ain't here. Excuse me while I disappear.
Of course, that's the amazing arrangement by Nelson Riddle. In the 1960s, for reasons that are hard to pin down, but that may have to do with a revival of interest in Baroque music, Glenn Gould playing the Goldberg variations and various other recordings that came out in the 50s and 60s, these very strict Baroque-style descending chromatic basses appear all over pop music. Here now is a somewhat zany montage of songs from the 60s and 70s.
Chim, chimney, chim, chimney, chim, chim, cheree. A sweep is as lucky can be. Chim, chimney, chim, chimney, chim, chim, cheroo. Good luck will rub off when I shake hands with you. Or blow me a kiss. And that's lucky, too.
But you don't understand.
there together again for the first time were Chim Chim Cheree from Mary Poppins, the Beatles, Michelle, the Eagles, Hotel California, and Bob Dylan's Ballad of a Thin Man, recorded live in Manchester in 1966. More to the point, I will also play Nina Simone's 1965 recording of the great anti-lynching song Strange Fruit. Simone, a classically trained pianist with a deep love of Bach, rewrote the accompaniment to feature a four-note lamento in the ancient style.
7 feet barren, strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the roots. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Somehow, centuries after the lamenting bass surfaced, its meaning remains the same. It summons up the texture of depression and despair, the heart descending step by step to the bottom and going back up to repeat the journey. It retains its cathartic effect, so that dark regions are filled with mysterious light. Such figures reveal the interconnectedness of musical experience. If you could bring together some late 16th century Spanish musicians, a continuo section led by Bach, players from Duke Ellington's 1929 band, perhaps, and then asked John Paul Jones to start them off with the bass line of Led Zeppelin's Dazed and Confused, they might, after a minute or two of confusion, find common ground. That's just the beginning of a 25-minute version of Dazed and Confused, which I will not play all of. And in Bob Dylan's 1975 song, Simple Twist of Fate, you find an eerie correspondence with an earlier lament. Here's a story of a man who has a brief affair with a woman, and when she walks away, he finds himself haunted by her, much as he tries to forget her. The song is in a major key, but it's anchored on that old descending chromatic bass and thus enters into an ambiguous sphere. As in Dido's Lament by Purcell, the bass line is laid out first in the instruments before the singer begins. And as in Purcell, the word fate plays a prominent role, indeed the idea of forgetting fate. This bass line seems to have fate built into it, but an interesting reversal has happened across the centuries. In Purcell's Dido, it is the man who is summoned away, leaving the woman bereft. In Dylan's smaller-scale tragedy, it is the woman who forgets, and the man who is left to contemplate the twisting and turning of fate.
A saxophone someplace far off played as she was walking on by the arcade. As the light bust through a beat-up shade where he was waking up, she dropped a coin into the cup above a blind man at the gate and forgot about his simple twist of fate.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you, everyone. We're going to have the opportunity to ask you some questions, and while you're thinking of someone, we have people with microphones here that walk up, and you can raise your hand. If you don't mind, I can prime the pump. I've noticed that so many of the classical examples were operatic, and I wonder if you think that there's any connection between that and, of course, pop music is almost, by definition, vocal. Is there any connection either in yourself or you feel in music itself, that a connection between classical and pop, that is a love of both, could be gotten just through the voice, the fact of the voice?
I think so, yes. But there's also this connection between the style of the Baroque and pop music, I think especially 50s, 60s, and 70s, and that's fascinating as well. But yes, I think with the voice and with the theatrical element, whether it's a staging on the opera stage or the theater of the rock show, the pop show, I think that that ostinato, the idea of the ostinato pattern churning underneath, works better. I think you can get away with it a little more easily. I think in instrumental music, it might create impatience after a little while, though of course there are many wonderful examples of purely instrumental pieces with this kind of pattern repeating. I think that's why the finale of Brahms's Fourth Symphony was so daring, because I actually think it is secretly somewhat operatic. I mean, the sort of supreme classicist of German music was turning back to the Baroque and turning back to a form that was associated with dance and also with opera, and placing it into the kind of sacred symphonic arena. And I find it incredibly dramatic music, just electrifying in the right hands. And the recording I played was Carlos Kleiber's amazing recording with the Vienna Philharmonic. But yes, I think that's a good way to point out the connection, the sort of operatic theatrical link.
That's the his Fourth Symphony is the opera that he never wrote then, I guess.
Perhaps.
a confession that how long I've been reading musical terms, it never occurred to me before that ostinato meant obstinate. I could have hit myself in the head when I read that. Questions? We have, do I see a hand? Right here? Yeah, wait for that.
I sort of had two brief thoughts. One is that I just thought of a couple jazz compositions that also had this sort of descending line. Thelonious Monk's Around Midnight, the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then Lonnie's Lament. I'm kind of forgetting the harmonic sequence, but just the title. it's Coltrane's. Did I say Monk? And I was wondering maybe if there were any other pieces in the jazz world. I'm sure there's like dozens more you would come across.
Yeah.
But
yeah, well, there's Ellington.
Oh.
What da do? Not a lament, of course,
yeah.
But it has that, I think that sort of darker kind of sultry atmosphere of that repeating bass line. I mean, this may well have been what Ray Charles was thinking of, you know, when he wrote Hit the Road, Jack. But yeah, jazz, I mean, it's an incredibly, you know, rich subject in itself. I'm sure there are many, many more. I'm a sort of, I love jazz, but I shy away from writing about jazz because of the expertise
sure.
that is really needed to write about it knowledgeably. So maybe I did avoid that terrain a little bit when I was writing this essay, but that's another obvious link, you know, between sort of the blues world and that mm-hmm. pop music of the 60s and 70s, and of course, you know, all the, so many of those jazz artists were aware of Bach in particular and fascinated by him.
I had one other quick thought, if that's all right. I was thinking about sort of, I don't know if this is the opposite, but rising progressions, And there were a couple of Dylan songs that I Shall Be Released and maybe A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall or something, where there's this hopeful feeling of the music.
Yeah, or like a Rolling Stone that keeps marching up and up and up. Yeah, that's something that actually I've done this talk a couple times and people have brought that up. And it's interesting. I think there's not a figure which is as easily identifiable as this lamento figure, which was really classified as such. I mean, you know, it was known as the basso lamento almost officially in the literature. These upward figures, you know, you can sort of feel their emotional connotation, but there isn't sort of a specific template which has really been identified as such. But it'd be interesting to sort of go through and try to sort of do a taxonomy of that kind of figure as well.
I wonder if the descending figure is often harmonic ground, whereas the ascending figure we often associate with a melodic configuration that goes over, no matter what the harmony is.
Well, once you get into the, sort of the shapes of melody, I think, you know, over the years, over the centuries, people have tried to create a kind of a science of melody, and sort of, you know, when a melody sort of goes in this direction, it means this, and when it goes in that direction, it means that. That's what Zarlino is doing back in that 1558 treatise. It's tricky, though, because there's always the examples that betray the rule.
And what the cultural conditioning might be.
Yeah.
I have a question right in the middle. If you're closest there, if you could pass that microphone over, that would help us. Thank you.
Hi. I really enjoyed that. Can you hear me? Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
I'm Tanya Kevorkian. We've corresponded. And I really wondered, I read that the Chaconne possibly came from Cuba. There were a couple of dances that surfaced in Spain in the 16th century that possibly resulted, they came from Cuba with some of the baseline deriving from African patterns, right? But although you mentioned, and I forget now whether it was the Chaconne or a couple of others.
Right.
And so I wonder if you could make a connection there. And you mentioned that the Chaconne had a Moorish, you know, an Arab precedent. And that really wouldn't be completely different, because the Arab world and the African world were in contact, right? And there were those centuries of slave trade from Africa to the Middle East.
Yeah, yeah,
with
absolutely.
That assimilation. So maybe it's remote and it's over centuries and all that. But, you know, through Africa, the blues, those figures, which also influenced rock.
Right.
You know, so there's this whole blend.
Yeah, I was fascinated by that, because I've read speculation to that effect, but a couple of the scholars who have gone over this territory very carefully don't quite see the evidence of an African connection with the Chaconne in particular. Sort of more kind of a rumor attached to the dance. People kept sort of mentioning, you know, that it sort of came from the Indies, or that it has this sort of a mixed, you know, association with some kind of, you know, mixing of the races, and that's mentioned in Cervantes, actually, Lope de Vega, when they name this dance. But it's hard to pin it down, and it's not even really certain where it came from, what the word means. It does seem to have popped up in South America, but, you know, not enough is known to really back that up. So I think it's sort of an interesting suggestion. I think with the Zarabanda, which was another very popular dance in the period, there I think you're on sure ground in finding a Cuban, actually specifically an Afro-Cuban association, because you find that word in Afro-Cuban religion. I forget the exact details of that, but the word does appear, and it has a connotation of this powerful spirit, animating spirit, and the musician scholar Ned Soblett writes about this in his fascinating history of Cuban music. So this is something we'd like to know more about, but unfortunately the records, the sort of early mentions of these dances are so sketchy that we just don't know where they came from exactly.
You also touched on the guitar a little bit, and I'm wondering if our questioner, when you were mentioning the different the countries, it almost seems to parallel the movement of the guitar throughout the world.
Absolutely, yeah. And then the Middle Eastern connection is also fascinating, yeah.
A question perhaps on this side? Oh, right in front here, yeah.
This may be a naive comment, but you didn't mention it, but in listening to the minimalist music, it has a taxonomy of ostinato, even though it may not be making use of the same intervals, or the harmonics may be different, but it has the same effect, emotional effect on the listener. Would you agree, or am I in a different place?
Definitely. No, definitely. And I think Philip Glass, in particular, has used that kind of four-note falling lamento pattern a lot. And, yeah, I mean, ostinato is an amazing device. I think it's central to so many different musical traditions, and it has great possibilities. I mean, it's sort of sometimes dismissed as simplistic, and when people criticize minimalist music, they say, well, there's just sort of the same thing being heard over and over again. But when the art of variation enters the picture, and as in the sort of great pieces by Steve Reich, what is happening on top of these repeating patterns grows ever more complex until you find actually that you're hearing something totally different from what you're hearing 10 or 15 minutes ago, but you didn't notice the transformation. It happens so gradually. I mean, this is great musical art, I think, and it really is the same principle of repetition and variation that you find in the Renaissance and Baroque masters as well.
Been a wonderfully inventive audience. You have time just for one more question in the back, right in the middle, right here. Get you over here. If you could pass that microphone over. Thank you.
Hi. Just sort of two things. What recording was that of Led Zeppelin that you played? Or what year? Or
The LA Forum, 1972.
Oh, okay. And I am, being a musician, I get this question a lot from friends that are non-musicians, and it doesn't exactly have to do with the lamento piece, but where are we exactly at in musical history? If you think of the developments in especially 20th century, and there's obviously a big schism where you can't just say there's a school that most composers write in nowadays, mm-hmm. or even starting in the 60s, 50s, or 40s. But to when I get this question, it's very difficult for me to put any sort of definition or explain it at all, other than to say maybe electroacoustic music or Radiohead. I don't know.
Yeah. That's very difficult. I think it's very, very hard to see one's own time. And when you look back in history and sort of read people struggling to come to terms with what was going on around them in their present day, you often find this idea that, well, sort of the music of the past, everything was rather clear, and there was the school of this and the school of that, but now it's all so confusing and overwhelming, and then there's so many different ideas swirling, and it's so fast-paced. And you find this, I think, in the 1880s and 1890s, you certainly find it in the 1920s, and again in the 1950s. And sort of when we look back, we tend to simplify, and we sort of take certain things out of the picture and concentrate on what we consider to be the main development. So we're no longer seeing that confusion. So I think, you know, over time, this period it may turn out to be a lot clearer, but I do think it does seem like a decade or a period very much like the 1920s, because, you know, there was all those contrary energies and sort of composers experimenting with popular sounds or going towards some kind of avant-garde extreme of using the sounds of machines and sort of the art of noise, and then on the other hand, you had popular musicians who had sort of aspirations or sort of took inspiration from classical music and started merging with classical tradition. You feel a lot of the same developments today. So there's kind of the swirl of possibilities and a kind of blurring of boundaries. And it may have something to do with economics. I mean, maybe this was the music of a boom time in a way, or of a bubble. And now in the present economic time, there may be kind of a drastic simplification, as certainly happened in the 1930s in music. So who knows? I'm actually really interested to see what happens in the next few years, because just at the moment when everything seems exhausted and all the possibilities seem played out, I mean, history tells us that is the moment when people step up and write The Rite of Spring, and something that absolutely astonishes everyone. So I'm hoping that's about to happen, and I'll get to write about it.
All right.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.